Strangers, did you know that May is Mental Health Awareness Month? It's been very refreshing to see the rise in mental health awareness in our culture. I've been aware of my mental health for about 35 years now. Unfortunately, the rise in awareness has made access harder, especially if you don't have lots of money. Rula makes finding a good online therapist not only easy, but affordable. That's because Rula does things differently. They partner with over 120 insurance plans, making the average copay just $15 a session. That's real therapy from licensed professionals at a price that actually makes sense. With Rula, you can find the right therapist for you. They partner with a network of over 23,000 therapists and psychiatrists nationwide, enabling you to find your personalized solution and the right therapist for you based on your needs, preferences, and state requirements. Rula providers are carefully screened and vetted, monitoring the quality of their care and helping you monitor your progress in therapy. This Mental Health Awareness Month, don't just think about your mental health, actually take the step to take care of it. Visit rula.com/strange to get started. That's rula.com/strange. You deserve mental health care that works with you, not against your budget. Hey, strangers, it's time for another Ask Me Anything episode by popular demand. If you have a question you've been dying to ask me, now's your chance. You can email me at contact@strangeandunexplainedpod.com. DM me on Instagram at SNUpod or head to the website strangeandunexplainedpod.com and fill out the contact form. Hey, strangers, I'm so excited to share the first ever listener-written episode. Listener Madeline Gasson reached out to me to see if I wanted to read a script she'd written and possibly use it on the show. I did, and it's a great script, so I'm sharing it with you today. It will be a little different in tone, obviously, but I think you'll enjoy it as much as I did. When we think of paradise on Earth, many people think of our oceans. We imagine crystal clear waters, white sand beaches, and swimming in cool water. I mean, people travel to beaches around the world just to relax and to cool off from the summer heat. But while modern society widely considers beaches and oceans a happy, relaxing paradise, our oceans were once a scary, mysterious, and dangerous place. Ocean currents could sweep ships away, never to be seen again. Unexpected storms would sink ships, and unusual creatures were causes for fear. The oceans were a treacherous place we didn't know much about, and as we started to explore more of the oceans, legends arose that helped us explain unknown phenomena. Legends like those of the Kraken and the Flying Dutchman provided explanations for the ocean's mysteries. But while these legends are widely considered myths, that doesn't mean they weren't based on real events. Ghost ships or ships found adrift without a living crew have been discovered for centuries, each in just as mysterious circumstances and most with absolutely no explanation. Today we'll dive into one of the most legendary ghost ships found on the Diamond Shoals of North Carolina. A shipwreck, missing lifeboats, a missing crew, and no explanation. On Monday, January 31st, 1921, United States Coast Guardsman C.P. Brady held the early morning shift at Cape Hatteras Life Saving Station. The early morning was misty and cold, with strong winter winds blowing the tops off the waves. The gathering morning light was just enough to see the coast he was keeping watch on. It was a slow morning as he watched the cawing seagulls flapping and circling, suspended by the wind. With only an hour and a half left of his watch, he rose from his lookout and went downstairs for a cup of coffee. He was starting to get a bit weary after staring at the same stretch of water for so long. But it was important for him to stay alert. A little bit of caffeine should do just the trick. Coming back to his perch, coffee in hand, he looked through the station's telescope, an important tool for keeping watch over the dangerous 12-mile Diamond Shoals that are dreaded by mariners all over the world. Scanning the shoals, Brady gazed into the thick morning mist, expecting nothing new. Suddenly, a strange shape caught his attention in the growing light. He set his cup down, rubbed his eyes, and checked again. He hadn't seen anything before his coffee break. There hadn't been any rockets, flares, or distress signals during the night. Was he imagining it? As the wind blew away the mist, the truth became undeniable. A large, five-masted schooner, sails raised, was trapped on the Diamond Shoals. Brady had no option but to shout the word every seafarer dreads: shipwreck. But to truly understand the danger this ship and its crew now faced, we need to step back and look at where this was all happening. The Diamond Shoals isn't just any stretch of water. It's among the most treacherous in the world. For thousands of years, North Carolina's barrier islands, widely known as the Outer Banks, have protected the mainland coast and offshore sounds. As an important part of the region's marine ecosystem, the barrier islands' long stretches of beach, sand dunes, marshes, and woodlands were set aside and were officially established as part of the Cape Hatteras National Seashore on January 12, 1953. The United States' first national seashore. This national seashore preserves over 70 miles of coastline and 30,000 acres of beaches, dunes, marshes, and woodlands. The environment provides valuable habitats for wildlife, including more than 360 documented bird species, as well as seals, dolphins, whales, sea turtles, land turtles, alligators, and other animals. Located in the Cape Hatteras National Seashore, the Diamond Shoals is a dangerous 12-mile-long sandbar off Cape Hatteras formed by the collision of the Gulf Stream and the Virginia Drift, a branch of the Labrador Current flowing from the Arctic. When these currents collide, they create a strong turbulence that essentially pushes southbound ships into the treacherous sandbar. It also doesn't help that while most sandbars are relatively stable, the Diamond Shoals constantly shift due to storms and changing currents, making navigation extremely difficult, especially back when ships mostly relied on maps and magnetic compasses for navigation. Between the current pushing the ships toward the sandbar and the sandbar constantly moving, it's no wonder that the Diamond Shoals have been the site of hundreds, if not thousands, of shipwrecks, earning it the name the Graveyard of the Atlantic. And on the morning of January 31, 1921, it was Coast Guardsman C.P. Brady who found the graveyard's latest victim. Once Brady raised the alert of a shipwreck, the rest of the Coast Guard made quick work of getting ready for the rescue. Time was of the essence, and the lifesavers stationed at Cape Hatteras were ready to risk their lives to save those stranded among the shoals. Jacob A. Miller, the keeper or commander of the Cape Hatteras life-saving station, quickly took charge and directed his men to prepare a surf boat. Once the surf boat was ready, the crew loaded it onto a boat carriage with a horse leading it across the sand and half a dozen men pushing it from behind. Together, they hauled the station's powerboat to the south hook of the Cape, but they already encountered a problem. The sea was running pretty high, and they decided to check the north point to see if it would have better launching conditions. Unfortunately, they found that the sea level was even higher in the north and had to return to their original plan of launching south. They were joined by two other crews from nearby stations, Kinnikeet and Creed's Hill, who were also set to help with the operation but couldn't launch from their own stations due to the sea conditions. While the extra manpower was helpful, precious time had already been wasted due to the difficult launching conditions. When the rescue boat was finally loaded into the water, Keeper Miller picked six rescuers and two boatswains to head out toward the wreckage and attempt a rescue. Unfortunately, the difficult conditions that had hindered the launching of the rescue boat persisted, and while they had initially launched the rescue boat at 10 that morning, rough seas made it difficult to get past the white water. And it wasn't until 11:30 that the boat began approaching the wreckage. When they reached the wreckage, they soon faced another problem. 2 to 3 story high waves were making it impossible to get closer than 500 yards to the ship. But despite being forced to keep a considerable distance from the ship, the rescuers could see that with all the sails set, the ship appeared to have been abandoned in a hurry. They could all see that the schooner's two lifeboats were gone, and the davit falls, steel wire ropes used to lower or hoist lifeboats, were hanging over the side. They circled the ship over and over again, looking for any movement or signs of life on board. But after several attempts to get closer, with no signs of the crew and unable to identify the vessel's name or home port, they had no choice but to head back to shore. The rescuers reached the shore at 1:10 p.m., and Keeper Miller notified the Coast Guard's 7th District Superintendent and Division Commander of the results of his crew's efforts. He knew there was nothing they could do until a larger vessel arrived to help them reach the wreckage. Early the following morning, the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Seminole, captained by Lieutenant Commander Dench, arrived to assist with the rescue. At 10:30 that night, Dench sent a telegram to Norfolk, Virginia, the closest major registry and crew signing port, detailing the conditions of the schooner and the crew, stating, quote, "No trace of crew schooner, stranded about center of outer shoal, apparently not badly damaged and all sail set, unable to approach closer than 1 mile in present sea as seas are breaking over her at present, but not breaking up," end quote. So at this point, they really had no idea what happened to this ship. They didn't even know its name. All they knew is that the ship seemed to have been abandoned in a hurry, that both lifeboats were missing, that the crew seemed to have simply vanished, and that, from what they could tell, the ship was in pretty good condition and was still seaworthy. 2 days after the ship was first discovered on the shoals, the wrecking tugboat Rescue, commanded by Captain James Carlson, was dispatched from Norfolk to assist in the rescue. At the same time, news of the shipwreck and rescue efforts began to break in the media. On the morning of Wednesday, February 2nd, the Ledger Dispatch printed the headline, quote, "Ship is abandoned. Crew is missing. All sails on schooner are set. Coast Guardsmen still can't get near enough to make out name," end quote. The Associated article asked all the questions the Coast Guard themselves couldn't figure out. Quote, "Where is the crew of the strange schooner wallowing helplessly in the seas off Diamond Shoals? Why was the vessel deserted with all sails set? A Coast Guard crew that has been frantically trying for 2 days to reach the strange ship, whose name is still a mystery, are puzzled by the peculiar circumstances under which the vessel was abandoned," end quote. Unfortunately, a continuation of bad weather and rough seas made it impossible to reach the shipwreck for several more days. And investigators were no closer to discovering what had happened to the ship than they were on the day it was first found. Strangers, if you're as serious about sleep as I am, you have the right mattress, your white noise machine, your lavender-scented eye mask, and your bedroom temp at a cool 63 degrees. But if you don't have the right sheets, you might as well forget all the rest. Miracle Made sheets are the last piece in your getting a great night's sleep puzzle. That's because Miracle Made sheets are made with silver-infused fabric inspired by NASA technology. That technology will help keep you sleeping at the right temperature for your body so you won't wake up drenched in your own sweat or shivering. And somehow, even with all that antibacterial silver, which prevents almost 100% of bacteria growth in there, Miracle Made sheets are so soft, it's like sleeping on 5-star hotel sheets without the luxury price tag. Plus, they stay cleaner longer, which means no gross smells and lots fewer loads of laundry. I love my Miracle Made sheets, and I think you will too. And if not, they have great customer service, which makes returns super easy. Upgrade your sleep or give the gift of better rest. Go to trymiracle.com/strange to try Miracle Made sheets today. You'll save over 40%. And when you use promo code STRANGE, you'll get an extra 20% off plus a free 3-piece towel set. They make an amazing gift, and with a 30-day money-back guarantee, there's no risk. That's trymiracle.com/strange, code STRANGE at checkout. Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. It wasn't until the morning of February 4th that Captain James Carlson was able to lead the tugboat rescue operation and finally board the ship. But while investigators hoped this milestone would at least shed some light on the circumstances that led to the shipwreck, they were met with even more unanswered questions. On the ship, Captain Carlson was met with an eerie sight. The crew, their personal belongings, and the ship's navigational equipment were missing. and food was in the middle of being prepared on the stove. Both of the ship's running lights, navigation lights used to prevent collisions, and two red lights in the rigging were lit. Rescuers found the schooner's steering equipment damaged, the wheel shattered, the binnacle box caved in, and the rudder completely disengaged from the stock, which shields and provides rotational support for the rudder. A sledgehammer leaned ominously nearby. Essentially, imagine a car with no brake pads or rotors, the steering column completely destroyed, the speedometer utterly useless, and the transmission completely shot, all damaged by what we can only speculate was a sledgehammer. Now, I'm not a car person, but I don't think I would want to drive that, and I can understand why the Deering's crew might choose to abandon ship. The damage could explain why the ship's two lifeboats, the crew's personal belongings, and the ship's navigational equipment would be missing if the crew had decided to abandon ship. But it doesn't really explain why the food was being prepared for the next day's meals, or how the steering equipment was damaged, or by whom. Rescuers also searched and examined the ship's cabins and below decks, but the only crew members they could find were three half-starved cats. The ship's papers, nautical instruments, chronometer, a precise timekeeping device used at sea, and the crew's clothing were all missing. Meanwhile, the ship's stores, signal flags, and other gear were all intact and untouched. Not to mention that pots of food, including split pea soup, spare ribs, and coffee, were still on the stove in the middle of being prepared. The crew's beds were unmade, dishes were unwashed, and navigating charts were found in the captain's bathroom. The discovery of the navigating charts in the bathroom was strange, since these would usually be kept in the captain's room in a dedicated area, like a desk, for easy access. This discovery fed the growing theory that something might have happened to the ship's captain before the ship ran aground on the shoals, and that someone, perhaps the first mate, had used the captain's room and kept his charts in the bathroom. While rescuers investigating the ship were unable to find any obvious evidence of foul play, like blood, they noted that 4 days of the ship scouring by waves would have washed away all evidence of a fight or murder anyway. After the search, the Evening Star, a local paper, even speculated, quote, that there had been trouble among the crew, a fight perhaps, a mutiny is the latest theory, end quote. Although the ship search didn't help investigators get any closer to finding out what happened to the ship or the crew, they were able to at least identify the ship as the Carol A. Deering, a large 5-masted schooner on its way back from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, stopping in Barbados. The Deering was built in Bath, Maine in 1919 by the G.G. Deering Company for commercial use. Now, this wasn't a small ship. It was 250 feet long, 44 feet wide, weighed 1,879 tons, and was designed to carry 3,500 tons of coal. It was actually the largest ship ever constructed by the G.G. Deering Company and was one of the last wooden cargo ships ever built. The Deering was first launched on April 14, 1919, so it was only around a year old at the time of the shipwreck. It should have been in near-perfect condition. What could have happened to the Deering for it to shipwreck so close to its final destination? Did something happen to the captain, like investigators suspected? Was there a mutiny? Investigators decided to look into the Deering's voyage, hoping to understand the events that led to the shipwreck. The Deering's final voyage began July 19, 1920, when the vessel left from Puerto Rico and arrived in Newport, Virginia, to pick up a cargo of coal that was set to be delivered to Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. At the time, the ship was captained by World War I hero Captain William H. Merritt, with his son Sewell B. Merritt as first mate. Everything seemed to be going according to plan on August 25, 1920, when the Carol A. Deering cleared the Virginia Capes and started heading for Rio. However, not long after, Captain Merritt fell extremely ill and the ship had to turn back in an emergency to Lewis, Delaware, where Captain Merritt and his son left the ship. The G.G. Deering Company replaced Captain Merritt with Captain Willis B. Wormell, a 66-year-old retired veteran sea captain, and appointed Charles McClellan as first mate. We don't have much information regarding this part of the ship's voyage, but we do know that the Deering's cargo was safely delivered to Rio de Janeiro on September 8, 1920. But with a new captain in tow, the crew passed through choppy international waters to get there and back. It wasn't exactly smooth sailing. Strangers, have you checked out Wild Grain yet? I love Wild Grain. It's the first ever fully customizable home delivery subscription for breads, pastas, and artisan pastries. Everything comes par-baked, which means you pop it in the oven for about 25 minutes or less and get delicious treats, like cheddar biscuits, cherry hand tarts, and rosemary garlic sourdough. The pastas cook in a few minutes, and I guarantee you, taste better than anything you'll get at the grocery store. It's just like my Nona would have made if she'd been Italian, or could have cooked at all. Unlike many store-bought options, Wild Grain uses simple ingredients you can pronounce and a slow fermentation process that can be easier on your belly and richer in nutrients and antioxidants. Wild Grain's boxes are fully customizable. In addition to their variety box, they have a gluten-free box, a vegan box, and a new protein box. Imagine having fresh, bakery-quality bread, pastries, and pasta at home without any trips to the store. And don't just take my word for it. They have over 40,000 five-star reviews and have been voted the best food subscription box by USA Today for 3 years in a row. For a limited time, Wild Grain is offering our listeners $30 off your first box, plus free croissants for life when you go to wildgrain.com/strange to start your subscription today. That's $30 off your first box and free croissants for life when you visit wildgrain.com/strange, or you can use promo code STRANGE at checkout. After the successful delivery, Captain Wormell granted his crew leave and met his good friend Captain Goodwin of the SS Lake Elon, who also happened to be in Rio at the same time. Wormell complained to his old friend about his crew, saying they were unruly and that he didn't trust any of them, especially not his first mate, McClellan. The only crew member that he trusted was the ship's engineer, Herbert Bates. While this confession was a bit worrisome, it wasn't really too much cause for concern. After all, Wormell had been hastily appointed as captain and didn't know any of the crew beforehand. It could be normal for there to be some tension on board, especially when you're crowded on a ship for months at a time, just floating in the ocean. Apparently, Goodwin thought similarly, since no action was taken after Wormell confessed his grievances about the crew to him. On December 2, 1920, the Deering had already left Brazil and stopped in Barbados for supplies, where Wormell once again gave his crew a few days' leave. Some reports say that Wormell took the opportunity of being at port to write letters to the Deering Company complaining about discipline problems and tensions with members of the crew, particularly involving First Mate McClellan. However, no verified documentation has ever been published, and copies of these letters, if they do exist, can't be found. What we do know for sure is that while in Barbados, Wormell spoke with another friend, Captain Hugh Norton of the August W. Snow, and complained again about his crew, further documenting tensions with them. So far, Wormell had taken every opportunity at port to meet up with a friend and complain about his unruly and untrustworthy crew, especially when it came to First Mate McClellan. It seems that the dynamic between the captain and his crew was just getting worse and worse as time went on. Wormell confided in Norton that he was especially having trouble with his first mate McClellan, who was reportedly habitually drunk while ashore and mistreated the crew. The drunken part of Wormell's complaint was proven to be true, at least in Barbados, when McClellan got extremely drunk and complained about his captain, Wormell, to Wormell's friend, Captain Norton. So, to summarize, Wormell first complained to Norton about McClellan, and later McClellan complained to Norton about Wormell. It's like a gossip triangle. In his drunken confessions, McClellan complained about Wormell's overbearingness and that McClellan couldn't even discipline the crew without the captain intervening. He also digressed that he had to do all of the navigation due to Wormell's poor eyesight. I think it's safe to say that there were some obvious tensions between Captain Wormell and First Mate McClellan, and McClellan was even later overheard by Captain Norton, Captain Norton's first mate, and another ship's captain, saying, quote,
"Yarr! I'll get to captain before we get back to Norfolk, I will."
We'll never really know for sure what McClellan meant by this. Did he mean to kill the captain? Did he want some other kind of revenge? Was it just some drunken blabbering that held no weight? We do know that McClellan was extremely drunk throughout his leave in Barbados. He apparently got so drunk that he was arrested. I guess he was being too rowdy and they must have charged him with disorderly conduct or something equivalent. He was taken to the local jail on January 9th, 1921, where Wormell was contacted about the situation. Once Wormell heard about this, he went straight to bail McClellan out of jail. Unfortunately for the rest of the crew, who I'm sure were just enjoying their time in Barbados, McClellan's arrest ended the crew's leave early, and they immediately set sail for Norfolk, Virginia. The next time that the Deering and its crew were seen was on January 28, 1921, off the coast of North Carolina, when the Deering hailed the Cape Lookout lightship. For those who don't know, because I sure didn't, a lightship is exactly what it sounds like, a specially equipped vessel anchored in a dangerous area that functions as a sort of floating lighthouse. Captain Jacobson, the lightship's keeper, later reported that a tall man with reddish hair and a foreign accent hailed him from the Deering, speaking through a megaphone. The ship had apparently lost both of its anchors in a storm off Cape Fear and asked that the ship's owners, the G.G. Deering Company, be notified of the situation. Unfortunately, Jacobson was unable to report the situation because his radio was broken and he couldn't abandon his post to return to shore. But the two lost anchors weren't the only strange things about Jacobson's encounter with the Deering. Jacobson noticed that the man who hailed the lightship didn't look or act like an officer, which was strange since an officer would usually be in charge of this kind of communication. Jacobson had also noticed that the crew was loitering on the quarter deck, a raised area of the ship's upper deck behind the main mast that serves as the command center and is usually reserved for the captain. Normally, a captain would have certainly reprimanded his crew for milling around in a restricted area, but Jacobson saw no sign of the ship's captain. The next afternoon, the crew of a different ship noticed the Deering sailing straight towards the infamous Diamond Shoals. While the crew that spotted the Deering found this strange, they reportedly had not seen anyone on the Deering's deck and decided to just leave them alone. Now, I've never been in that situation, but that seems like a strange choice. Imagine you see a ship with no one on deck sailing straight for a dangerous sandbar nicknamed the Graveyard of the Atlantic, and you don't report it right away? You assume it'll be fine? I don't know, it seems weird to me. Regardless, what happened to the Deering and its crew between January 29th, when the Deering was lost, and the 31st, when she was discovered, remains a mystery. The next time that she would be spotted was when Coast Guardsman C.P. Brady spotted the shipwreck and initiated the rescue. With the search of the ship coming up empty, attention turned to what could be salvaged from the ghost ship. Salvageable equipment such as sails, furniture, flags, and a well-stocked medicine cabinet was removed and sold at public auction. A Bible belonging to Captain Wormell was also removed from the ship and sent to his daughter, Lula Wormell. Later, the Coast Guard cutter USRC Manning tried to salvage the Deering and tow it out of the shoals, but the Deering was simply far too stuck in the sandbar. It's uncertain whether the shipwreck was left on the shoals to be destroyed by the waves, or whether it was initially blown up, and then a larger part of the wreckage that had drifted was dynamited again. What we do know is that the wreckage, or part of it, was deemed a navigational hazard and was blown up with dynamite on March 21, 1921, to keep the wreckage from posing a threat to other ships. Later, a portion of her bow, the forwardmost part of the ship, drifted ashore on Ocracoke Island, and wooden timbers from the wreck also washed up on Hatteras Island, which were allegedly used by locals to build houses. So, at least a bit of good came from the shipwreck. If you're interested in visiting a part of the Deering's wreckage, the ship's capstone and bell are on display at the graveyard of the Atlantic Museum in Hatteras. While the mysterious circumstances surrounding the Carol A. Deering shipwreck prompted a basic maritime investigation by the U.S. Coast Guard, authorities were making no progress and were unable to come up with a concrete explanation for the disappearance of the crew. But one person refused to give up on finding the truth, and that person was Captain Wormell's daughter, Lula Wormell. Strangers, the other day I turned to my husband and said, wouldn't it be neat if our living room blinds were controlled by a switch? And he was like, you know they have those, right? Listen, whether or not I thought I'd invented something that was going to make me a millionaire or not is not the point. The point is, when we're ready, we can go to 3-Day Blinds and get ourselves switch or remote controlled blinds. We could even get the kind of blinds that you just tell Alexa to open and close, but I don't want my house listening to me more than it already is. Not very handy, DIY projects can be fun, but measuring and installing blinds can be a big challenge. The expert team at 3-Day Blinds handles all the heavy lifting. They design, measure, and install, so you can sit back and relax and leave it to the pros. With 3-Day Blinds, you choose from thousands of options that fit any budget or style. Plus, from light filtering and blackout blinds to motorization and smart blinds, 3-Day Blinds is a real upgrade to your home, not just a replacement. 3-Day Blinds has been in business for over 45 years, and they've helped over 2 million people get the window treatments of their dreams. So, they're a brand you can trust. Right now, get quality window treatments that fit your budget with 3-Day Blinds. Head to 3dayblinds.com/strange for their buy one, get one 50% off deal on custom blind shades, shutters, and drapery. For a free, no charge, no obligation consultation, just head to 3dayblinds.com/strange. One last time, that's buy one, get one 50% off when you head to the number 3, dayblinds.com/strange. As soon as she heard about her father's disappearance, Lula Wormell refused to believe that the disappearance of the crew was a simple accident. I mean, imagine your father disappears in a shipwreck and authorities have absolutely zero answers as to what happened. I think it would be pretty hard to just accept that you'll never really know for sure what happened or if your dad is even still alive. But the authorities conducted their basic investigation and thought it was good enough, even if they never found any definitive answers. So Lula took it upon herself not only to investigate the disappearance, but also to campaign for a larger investigation. She kind of became her own version of Nancy Drew and chased down any leads that pointed to the shipwreck not being an accident. Months later, Lula's hunch that the disappearance of the crew was no accident was finally given some credibility when, on April 11, 1921, a message in a bottle was found detailing the events that led to the disappearance of the Carol A. Deering's crew. Christopher Columbus Gray, a local fisherman in North Carolina, was fishing peacefully when he suddenly found a message in a bottle. Opening it, the message inside read, quote, Deering captured by oil-burning boat, something like chaser. Taking off everything. Handcuffing crew. Crew hiding all over ship. No chance to make escape. Finder, please notify headquarters, Deering. End quote. Imagine Gray's surprise when he found that note. The mystery of what happened to the Deering and its crew had been plaguing the public for months, with investigators getting no closer to answers than when the rescuers first boarded the ship. Finally, Gray had found the answer everyone was looking for. The Deering had been attacked. Gray promptly turned the note into the authorities, and the handwriting on it was later identified by Captain Wormell's widow as that of Henry Bates, the ship's engineer. Although we're not really sure how Mrs. Wormell knew what Henry Bates' handwriting looked like, everything was finally starting to line up. Even the bottle the note was found in was manufactured in Brazil at the Deering's cargo drop-off point and where the crew was given the longest leave time. The discovery of the note, as well as the record of a mysterious steamer boat that arrived at Cape Lookout Lightship right after the Deering, seemed to support the message's allegations of hostile action toward the crew of the Deering. Jacobson, the lightship's captain, whose radio was broken, recalled that he attempted to hail the mystery steamer so that he could relay the Deering's message that they had lost both of their anchors, because if you remember, the Deering had lost both of its anchors in a storm off Cape Fear. But the steamer didn't respond, and Jacobson was unable to get the name of the ship since it was covered with a canvas. And while the hostile takeover seemed like a plausible explanation for whatever happened to the Deering and its crew, especially since the note's handwriting had allegedly been verified by Mrs. Warmell, some thought that the explanation seemed a bit too convenient, and not everything was adding up. Would Henry Bates, the supposed author of the note, have had time to find a pen, paper, and bottle, write the message, cork the bottle, and throw it into the sea while the ship was being taken over? Why would the message say to alert the G.G. Deering Company and not the authorities? Shouldn't the authorities have been notified in order to rescue the crew and investigate the takeover? Despite these lingering doubts, the discovery of the message brought the mystery back into the national spotlight. For Lula Warmell, Captain Warmell's daughter, it was exactly the spark she needed. She wasn't ready to let the investigation fade away, not when there were still so many unanswered questions. Lula began campaigning even more intensively for an expansion of the investigation, and in May 1921, Lula herself, Captain Merritt, the Deering's former captain who fell ill and left the voyage, and Reverend Dr. Addison Lorimer visited Washington, D.C. to meet with U.S. Senator Frederick Hale. Together, they convinced Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover to initiate a large-scale federal investigation involving five government departments: the U.S. Navy, Treasury, Commerce, Justice, and State. Because of her persistence, Lula is credited by many historians as the one who kept the case alive in the press and with the government, especially after the message in a bottle appeared. Thanks to her efforts, she turned the Deering case from a local maritime mystery into an interdepartmental national investigation led by Lawrence Ritchie, Herbert Hoover's very own assistant. Once the large-scale investigation was initiated, investigators were especially interested in the message in a bottle found by Christopher Columbus Gray in April 1921, since this was really the only lead they had. The note was forwarded to the departments involved in the investigation and received a more detailed analysis. Unfortunately, investigators reached another dead end when handwriting experts concluded that the note was forged and not written by Henry Bates, as they previously believed. In fact, after further questioning from federal agents, Gray confessed to having forged the note. Apparently, after having heard of the mysterious disappearance of the Deering's crew and Cape Hatteras Light Station's involvement, being the station that first spotted the shipwreck, Gray came up with a scheme to help him get publicity while simultaneously, quote-unquote, solving the Deering case. He had hoped that the publicity would help him secure a job at Cape Hatteras Light Station, something he'd been vying for quite a while, but was always turned away because there were no open positions. In the end, his scheme backfired, and it seems he was unable to get the job at the Cape Hatteras Light Station while also leaving authorities once again back at square one in their investigation. With nowhere else to turn, investigators attempted to chart exactly what happened to the Deering between her being spotted at the Cape Hatteras lightship and her running aground on the shoals. Lawrence Ritchie and several other government investigators spent months reading the logbooks of Coast Guard lightships that were in the area at the time and tracking down every possible lead. Investigators, including FBI agent Thompson, the agent initially assigned to examine Gray's infamous message in a bottle, spent months in Dare County, the closest county to the shipwreck, chasing down leads, interviewing lighthouse and lightship crew, tracking down fishermen who may have seen the ship, and investigating rumors about the crew reaching shore. Agent Thompson even asked local Coast Guardsmen whether it was possible that the crew had mutinied and abandoned the ship before striking the shoals. They responded that it was impossible since the coast was too rough for lifeboat landings and that any good crew would have known that. although authorities were able to confirm that there were hurricanes nearby when the Deering shipwrecked, no other leads panned out, and investigators were faced with dead end after dead end. With no new leads to go on, no trace of the crew, the ship's logs, or the missing navigation equipment, the investigation eventually fizzled out in late 1922 without citing any official finding for the disappearance of the crew in the subsequent report, and the public accepted mutiny as the unofficial explanation for the Deering crew's disappearance. To this day, there are five main theories that could explain the disappearance of the Deering crew. The most plausible theory is that the crew abandoned ship due to a particularly strong hurricane. Strong hurricanes are not uncommon on the East Coast, and the U.S. government, specifically the Weather Bureau, was adamant that a series of powerful hurricanes was plaguing the Atlantic at the time. According to this theory, the hurricanes would not only explain the disappearance of Carol A. Deering's crew, but also other ships' disappearances as well. Specifically, the SS Hewitt, which disappeared under similar circumstances not long after the Deering. However, if we look closer at Deering and Hewitt's trajectory, both ships were sailing away from the hurricanes. Since conditions tend to get better as you get away from said hurricane, it seems unlikely that this theory would explain the shipwreck. Another possible and highly popular theory is piracy. This theory was very popular among the public, and Lula, the captain's daughter, was a strong advocate for it. From what we know, piracy could be a very good explanation for the crew's disappearance. Why else would the Deering's wheel be smashed and the next day's meal be left in the middle of preparing? This theory was even more popular when news of the message in a bottle circulated. But, with the note proven a hoax, there's simply no evidence to support the theory that piracy led to the crew abandoning the Deering and ultimately disappearing. On a somewhat similar note, some members of the public considered whether Russian or communist piracy could be to blame. Although the Deering crew's disappearance occurred before the Cold War, the United States was still in its first wave of the Red Scare. The first wave started in 1917 and was triggered by the Russian Revolution and post-war labor strikes, and continued into the 1920s. This form of mass hysteria, driven by intense fear of communist infiltration, nuclear war, and Soviet espionage, led to intense government raids of Russian organizations. In a raid of the headquarters of the United Russian Workers' Party, a communist organization, officers allegedly found papers that called on members to seize American ships and sail them to the USSR as part of a Bolshevik plot, a scheme organized under the direction of the Bolshevik Party, later known as the Communist Party. U.S. government officials took a hard stance against communism and were very supportive of this theory, but while the papers seized in the raid called for American ships to be seized, there is no evidence to prove that one of those ships was the Carol A. Deering, or that this had any relevance to the Deering case. Another possibility was that rum runners were to blame. The disappearance of the Deering occurred during the Prohibition era, a nationwide constitutional ban on the production, importation, transportation, and sale of alcoholic beverages in the U.S. from 1920 to 1923. Because the production and transportation of alcohol was illegal during Prohibition, rum runners played the critical role of smuggling large amounts of foreign alcohol into the U.S. via ships. Rum runners mainly operated along the Atlantic coast and from the Bahamas, both locations that were part of the Deering's route back to Virginia. This led to speculation that liquor smugglers working out of the Bahamas wanted to steal the Deering and use her to run rum. Since the Deering was a very large ship, it was thought that rum runners might want her in order to transport large amounts of liquor at once. But if rum runners really wanted to steal a ship, why would they pick such a big, conspicuous ship? Wouldn't it be a bit suspicious? Especially since the Deering Company would most likely report the occurrence? You'd think that rum runners, or anyone smuggling anything really, would need to be discreet. There was also a rumor that the Deering was carrying $1 million worth of liquor in her cargo hold. Since her cargo hold would have been empty after her delivery in Brazil, It is possible that the crew was attempting to smuggle $1 million worth of liquor into the US, but the supposed liquor was never found during the investigation. While this rumor was never proven, it could have further incentivized the rum runners to target her, or members of the crew could have been working with the rum runners. The last theory is often considered the unofficial explanation for the abandonment of the Carol A. Deering: mutiny. The conflict between Captain Wormell and First Mate McClellan was well documented, with several reports having been made throughout the Deering's journey and suggested that there may have been trouble between Wormell and the crew. Captain Jacobson at Cape Hatteras Lookout later remarked that, quote, the Deering was a bit off. He recalled that the man who hailed the lightship was definitely not Captain Wormell and did not seem like an officer. This was strange, since it would usually have been an officer's job to handle such communication. Even Senator Frederick Hale, who was instrumental in convincing Herbert Hoover to launch a nationwide investigation, believed that what had happened to the Deering was a clear case of mutiny that ultimately led to the crew's disappearance. While the crew's discontent with Captain Wormell could have been the root cause of such mutiny, there was still no concrete evidence that mutiny occurred or that it led to the crew's disappearance. Over 100 years later, people continue to be fascinated by this story, and speculation about what happened remains strong. Now that time has passed and we have some emotional distance from the events, people re-examine the story through a more analytical lens. It is possible that the Deering's crew might have simply abandoned ship after the Deering was grounded on the Diamond Shoals, and that the crew was unfortunately unable to make it to shore in the rough conditions, was swept out to sea, and later died in the two small lifeboats. Regarding the involvement of the SS Hewitt, I'd remarked that the Coast Guard found distress signals that had been lit on the Deering, the two red lights lit high in the rigging. Since the Hewitt was known to have been in the area, there's some speculation that the Hewitt actually saw the Deering's distress signals and picked up the crew before the Hewitt went down itself. In this case, the Deering's crew would have unfortunately escaped death on their own ship, only to meet it on their rescuers. Others believe that some paranormal or supernatural event is to blame for everything. The most popular of these explanations is the Bermuda Triangle, an urban legend focused on a loosely defined region in the western North Atlantic Ocean where numerous aircrafts and ships are said to have disappeared under mysterious circumstances. However, this theory seems unlikely since the Bermuda Triangle is hundreds of miles away from the Diamond Shoals where the Deering shipwrecked and the crew was spotted on board at Cape Hatteras Lookout, effectively ruling out the crew disappearing while the ship was in the Bermuda Triangle. To me, though, mutiny seems like it might be the most likely, despite there not being any concrete evidence to support the theory. I mean, we know that there was discontent among the crew and that tensions were high, especially between Captain Wormell and First Mate McClellan. That part's well documented. I'm sure that tensions get even higher when you're spending weeks at sea on a ship. Maybe it just got to be too much. Maybe the Deering's mutinous crew took over the ship and took Captain Wormell captive. This would explain why an officer wasn't the one who hailed the Cape Lookout lightship and why the crew was idling on the ship's quarter deck. It's possible that Captain Wormell escaped as the ship got closer to Diamond Shoals and, thrown into a fit of rage over his crew's mutiny, smashed the equipment with the sledgehammer in a sentiment of, "If I can't captain my ship, no one can." The crew would then have had to abandon ship and take Captain Wormell with them, or kill him, in order to prevent others from knowing what truly happened. This would explain the organized evacuation and why the crew's personal effects and the ship's navigation equipment were missing. Unfortunately, since the seas by the shoals are too rough for lifeboats to survive, the mutinous crew and its captain would have died at sea. Of course, this is just personal speculation, but it might be a good explanation. Sadly, to this day, there is no official explanation for what happened to the Carol A. Deering or its crew, and it's unlikely that we will ever have one. The Carol A. Deering ghost ship is considered one of history's greatest maritime mysteries. Thank you. Next time on Strange and Unexplained, we'll revisit an episode from season one with some new updates and commentary, near-death experiences. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment and Grab Bag Collab. This episode was researched and written by Madeline Gassin. The sources Madeline used for today's episode were Ghost Ship of Diamond Shoals, The Mystery of the Carol A. Deering by Bland Simpson, Legends of America, Discovery UK, National Park Service, United States Coast Guard, Library of Congress, Fisherman's Voice, The Washington Herald, The Evening Star, The Washington Times, The New York Herald, and the podcast North Carolina's Ghost Ship, Shipwreck Sunday. Sound mixing and design for today's episode by Becca DiGregorio. If you have an idea for an episode or want to submit a question for an Ask Me Anything episode, head to strangeandunexplainedpod.com and fill out the contact form. I will write back. Eventually, I need an assistant. You can follow me on social media at Daisy Egan or follow the show at SNU Pod and Grab Bag Collab. Stay strange.